When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back for the final episode of season 5, episode 10, BizQuick. Aaron, I gotta know, we've been generally cool on this entire season. Did the finale do anything to change that for you?
I've warmed up to it as the season went on. I'll say that I think this last third is the things definitely come into focus of what Holly was trying to do. I want to say two things. One, I think the last 20 minutes of this episode is amongst the finest television, just disconnected from everything else that I've ever seen in terms of the pacing, the performances, the themes. I want to get that out there. I thought it was incredible. That final last scene especially is that guy did. I forget the actor's name who plays Ule Munk. Mm-hmm. But his acting of being forgiven from his sins and achieving some kind of forgiveness and genuine unconditional love was beautiful, and I don't know how you act that, but he did it.
He did.
Second is, I think Noah Hawley, who was born and raised in New York City, his mother, a feminist author of literature, that Noah Hawley set out to make a fairy tale parable to reassure people like him that institutions will hold and people will get what's coming to them. And a lot of people are really experiencing some catharsis, apparently, from this, from what I can see. But I feel very cold. I'm not reassured. I'm very fearful. If you've listened to Bald Move for those last 10 years, you've heard me first jokingly and then increasingly, like the monkey paws are curling, state that, like, man, we might just be doomed to repeat the early 20th century. In the 21st century. I don't know. I want to believe that people like Roy can be stopped before it's all too late by our institutions, and they'll be brought to justice. I'm not sure I agree with this episode's the viewing of justice. I don't know. I thought some of this stuff was really puzzling, or just not made for me. It's just not made for a person with, you know, my background, my life experiences. Mm-hmm. It just didn't resonate with me. But I quite like the things that they said about debt and the obligations we have to each other. I quite like the character of Ule Munk. I really like Dot. Why do they have to kill Wilt Farr? Except for, like, I guess that's the thing. It's like, well, even if you stop a guy like Roy, while he's thrashing around running amok, the people who suffer are women and minorities.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, he'll eventually be caught. So,
yeah, I largely agree that Holly has identified the disease, but I don't know that I agree with his prescribed cure. Because I don't think it's that simple. I don't think it's a matter of... we could talk about it a lot when we get to the final moments of this episode, but I don't think it's a matter of just love and support being the thing we need to cure this, which is what I took away from the end of this. and I don't think that I like you said, the prescription of this is justice for this bad person because it's being perpetrated by another bad person wielding tools that I think are inherently bad and should not be used for those purposes at all. I find it really hard to root for anything that happens to Roy, even though I despise Roy because of the way it goes down. But I do think the end of this season, it brought together everything he was trying to say, which is, I guess, as much as I could hope for a season where I was A, largely already on the side of everything he's trying to say, and B, not sure that it was going in, not sure that it was hitting the tone I wanted it to hit throughout most of it. I think the tone it hits at the very end is really strong.
Yeah.
Because yeah, I found myself, and even though I, like I said, I don't necessarily agree with the prescription, and I don't think I was primed to really feel much of anything at the end of this because I was just kind of nodding along with him the whole time. Yeah, this is, I agree. Yeah, this is the problem. He managed to wring some emotion out of me at the very end and a feeling of warmth. And if, like, I sat with old Munch there eating that biscuit and I'm like, yeah, this feels good. This feels right. Which I didn't think I would say at the end of this season, based on everything I had seen up till now.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It's kind of a miracle that he pulled that resolution out of this entire season and had it resonate so well with me. So, like, yeah, if the other stuff was working for you, then I see that the subreddit is just going crazy, gaga.
Oh, yeah,
season.
They love it.
A lot of feedback is that way. All the critical notice on that. So like I said, clearly I'm missing something. And again, I think it does work as, like, I don't think you're supposed to take it literally. It is very much a fairy tale. I think there's a lot of stuff that Munch says in this episode that kind of, like, gives the gives it away that this is not to be taken literally.
Oh, for sure.
But even then, it's like, you know, when you're if you're reading The Little Boy Who Cries Wolf, and at the end of that story, if the wolf eats the little boy, it's like, well, okay, I get the moral lesson, but goddamn, we just ate a little boy, you know? I don't know if that's the lesson I want children to come away from. But, like, you know, sometimes you get weird shit like that in a fable or a fairy tale. But that's what we got.
As far as the themes and the fairy tale nature of Munch himself, and I'm gonna keep calling him Munch. I'm sorry, old Munch. I know it's Ula Munch. Munch is how he
says
it.
That's all right, Jim. I'll forgive you.
Okay. I think all that stuff actually on second examination works super well. And I'm not bothered. I guess I'm not bothered at all by the supernatural nature of it, him being 500 years old, because he is a stand-in for the acceptance of the debt, the acceptance of the shit that we deal with in the name of rich people doing their shit, right? Yes. He is supposed to be the embodiment of us just rolling over and taking it. And I think where they get to at the end of this is pretty profound with him, and I found myself surprised by how much I liked this ending, given my resistance to the supernatural character, my resistance to being preached to as part of the choir. All that stuff kind of melted away at the end. So, good job. Good job, I guess.
Yeah, and I've heard our political divides, and not just in America, this is around the world, framed in different ways. Like, it's democracy versus authoritarianism, it's liberalism versus fascism, I think the one insightful way to look at that is it's like people and groups and individuals that believe in institutions and people that reflexively don't trust institutions. And I am a big institutional guy.
Right.
I will trust an institution with rules and ability to change those rules, with insight and comments from my fellow citizens, that have hearings and transparency. I will trust those public institutions a million times more than I'll trust a private institution like a corporation. And a million times more will I trust those than an individual who could have all kinds of selfish motivations and stuff. The whole idea of us making these institutions is to make something that's better than us. It's the collection of us. It's something that we can hold up, look at from all angles, and decide every once in a while, is this thing still working for us? Is this still good? Is this thing executing its responsibilities in a faithful way? And I feel like there's a lot of people on both the left and the right, although the people on the right seem to have actually more power, a lot of people are just rejecting institutions. And that's scary to me in the 21st century because, you know, that's the reason we have vaccines and healthcare and spaceships and highways and things from coast to coast.
Our society is built on them, and you remove the institutions, what happens to the society?
Yeah, like we'll just roll back 150 years when our seniors died in the streets and, you know, children died of easily treated diseases and we had to have a birth rate six times higher to maintain it. It's bad. It's not good. Like, you want to make an argument to roll back like all the way agriculture and we go back to hunter-gatherer and we just wear loincloths and kill a saber-tooth tiger every 2 weeks and the rest of the time we're just fucking and whittling and making art? I'm on board with the return to monkey.
You just got to be okay with about 6 billion of us dying.
Right. Yeah. But rolling back 100 years, I am not good with. I am not. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of problems 100 years ago.
And Yeah.
Still a lot of problems today, but.
Yeah. So I think that I kind of admire that Holly, because that seems like that is the thing. It's like, you know, that we can trust in institutions. They can protect us. They can stand against these individual as a bulwark against the individual whims that try to tear us apart. So I like that as well. And again, like I have no idea what they were doing with the advanced interviews, billing the season as like a fun romp, Home Alone kind of thing. Like there were like the tracest elements of those things found in this, but this is a pretty heavy tome
for sure.
Although I cracked up more in this episode than I probably have in the entire season.
Wayne slayed me in this episode, man.
What a fucking
king. He was
king.
So pitch perfect in those scenes with Munch.
When he toasted him with the orange pop off camera, about fucking lost it.
Yes,
and then
it
the
was
whole
perfect,
like deathly silence, and then like we saw a tiger once at the Minnesota Zoo. It's like, oh, he's just perfect. He's perfect.
He is, and he rides the line between is he oblivious or does he know? Is he selling here? And I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you, and it's perfect.
Yeah, and the way you kind of see the way that Dot was talking to Indira about how she's back of the house, he's front of the house. It's like their partnership worked perfectly in that scene.
Yes, absolutely. And even Scotty getting in with just a pitch perfect thing there with the biscuits and guiding Munch through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great scene. Several great scenes in this episode. Maybe we should get into the recap so we can talk about all of them.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Fargo with Bald Move. We'll be right back. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We'll be right back.
getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Welcome back to Fargo on Bald Move.
We are still out on the Tillman Ranch, where Gator manages to free his hands, but he's still blind, so he's stumbling around until he finds the dugout and the escape tunnel, which he follows. And there's kind of a lot of, like, quick cuts back and forth to show us the state of the board as we're doing this. The standoff is still happening. Roy's kind of in church. He spits on the floor in church.
Calling the old man out.
Yeah. And you see Witt's team is kind of on the move here.
Yeah, I really like that scene of Gator kind of blind and groping for the light, and he finds this tunnel, and as he goes down it, the camera spins upside down to both harken back to his career as Steve on Stranger Things, but also to let us know this character is undergoing a spiritual transformation.
Yeah.
I like that. I thought it's pretty funny that they show the gravy seals lining up against a barbed wire fence
with no armor,
like just some shotguns and bolt action rifles. And they show the line of FBI and SWAT guys, and they're behind their police cars and their armored vehicles, and they're armored and helmeted with the latest tactical gear. And of course this is going to be a slaughter. They're just selling that like, my God. But it's a little dumb because I'm like, surely these people understand that this barbed wire fence
provides no cover. Zero.
I mean, yeah, there's a difference between concealment and cover. This provides neither.
Correct.
You know, like I don't think it slows down a sprinting man as a barricade, you know, like I think that's intentional that these guys who think they have $500,000 attack gear, which was not in evidence. That's the other thing I was surprised at. Like, I wonder if they're like Odin just embezzled this. None of what they have is what you would call is any kind of modern tactical equipment. Flannels, tactical shotguns.
I've never
shotguns,
seen a $1 million bolt action hat.
Yeah. They did have that one machine gun welded to that one dump truck. That might have stopped some small arms, but they're just telling you that like this is the real deal versus the weekend warriors.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
the people that know nothing but tactics versus the people that have tactics, strategy, and logistics, and they're going to win.
Yep, and I think Roy not taking any responsibility here for getting himself into this situation, and Odin's gonna step up and point out all this shit here in a bit, but he's blaming God, you know? For some, yeah. Somehow God is the one who has forsaken him here and gotten him into all this trouble. When
he carved this in his bones, and now he's pussing out the last yard.
Fair.
But here again, this is his being a baby. He wants all the freedom and none responsibility, and that certainly is not any definition of man I know.
Yeah. Gator emerges from the tunnel behind the FBI lines, and he hears them and stumbles off toward them. I don't know if he realizes who this is that he's stumbling off toward, but
right, he
does have a change of heart somewhere along the way.
Yeah, and his dad just literally abandoning him at his worst, lowest hour probably greases those wheels. I thought this him pumping out of that tunnel reminded me a lot of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where they're tunneling out of the prison through the mud and they escape that. I thought there's a little bit of a Coen brothers fingerprint there.
Sure. And then Odin decides to go in on Roy about how badly he and his family have fucked up this whole situation. So Roy kills him. Roy just cuts his neck. He's done. Karen sees that and kind of runs around the corner, and Roy, being the asshole he is, decides to go chase after her and runs straight into Dot with a gun, with a rifle. And she shoots him, but it's not a kill shot. And Wit hears this shot, and his team announces themselves. I'm going to kind of stop here so we can talk about it.
I have an observation and then a question. I really thought it was so funny when John Hamm comes around a corner and says, you seen a man in a dress come through here with a haircut like the Three Stooges?
Mm-hmm.
That was really funny. The little Minnesota that he had in his Don Draper. And then my question is, did Karen set him up? Did she know she was leading him around the corner for Dot to be standing there with the rifle?
I don't know. I can see this going two ways, that she did it intentionally because, Roy saw her earlier. I don't know if she knows that Roy saw her laying on the floor and just walked right past without a care in the world. And that turned her, or if Dot's words finally sank in and they teamed up. The other option is Dot was standing there waiting for him, and Karen comes running around the corner. She decides not to shoot her because she's a victim here too. I think the latter is probably more likely.
Yeah, especially since there is this stare when the FBI comes and, everyone's taking cover, and Officer Farr, because he's a badass, is covering Dot because he doesn't want her to die, and Karen's kind of left to cower behind the cement steps of the porch. But when the FBI are kind of like rolling everybody up, and they're like, the one guy's helping Dot off of the, and like the sound has dropped out, and she's like, did he get away? If you notice in the background, Karen is just staring daggers at her. So if she did conspire, it must have been just as a way to save herself and her kids, and she still just hates Dot. Mm-hmm. That's some sick psychology, man, that you can love this man. Or maybe be angered that you're losing your place, your position, your power. I don't know, but it's like, it's wild. Yeah. And I know it happens. I've seen it, not to this extent, but I've definitely seen a woman skewer another woman for shit that her man really did.
Sure.
Yeah. It's sad, but I do think, I don't think that they're in on it together as much as I'd like for that to happen.
Yeah. I keep going back to Roy describing it as breaking her, like as in a horse, right? Just teaching her that this is who you're going to be, and there's nothing you can do about it. Which makes me think that Karen did not plan this with Dot. But
when did you think Roy decided to kill Odin?
It seems as soon as they started standing up and taking their coats off to fight. He was all in. He was going to kill him there.
There's this point where he was saying, like, I and your boy is a fuck up, where it was on Roy's face, and Roy's eyes kind of widened, his nostrils flared. Because he's first talking like, I'm just going to kick your ass, old man. I'm going to kick your ass. Take out your dentures so I don't break them. But yeah, I don't know what Odin was thinking, because I don't know on his best day he takes Roy, like maybe 15 years ago. But
That's the thing. These two guys are so caught up in their own image of masculinity that it leads them down stupid roads. Just obviously blindingly stupid roads.
I've definitely seen a lot of dudes take ass beatings for nothing but their own pride.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah, like every bar fight ever, right?
Yeah, it's usually like, what in the hell are you thinking picking a fight with it? Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a real life Jack Reacher, you know? This is parade of 5'6" dudes going against 6'5". You know, it's like, what is
bunch
this?
Of Amos
Come
Burdens.
On.
Yeah.
Just apologize, man. You didn't know you bumped into a man monster. Just humble yourself a little bit. You're going to get split down the middle, dude.
Yeah. No, that's what it felt like. It's just dicks swinging and just pointing them in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And I don't think, so my question is, does Odin know what kind of guy Roy is? Because at every turn, he's judging him as a weak, soft person. And I don't think... Look, in some terms, that's true. I think, yes, he is a bit of a baby in the way that Lorraine described it. But also, he's a man who's willing to jump to extreme violence at a drop of a hat. We've seen it over and over. I mean, the killing of Danish, the killing of that dude who was beating his wife. Like, he's ready to kill. Odin doesn't know that?
Maybe Odin thinks he's I don't know, because that's the other thing about these communities is I don't know to the extent to how self-aware they are that you guys are parodies of masculinity, and the fact that you guys are all talking about how, you know, you're all true blue and you keep your word, and then the second there's a problem, it's all a bunch of lies and gossip, and I never liked that guy and fuck that guy. And you see it in the politics at the national stage right now, the like, oh, this is the best person, he's impeccable quality, and then like 6 weeks later, oh, this is the worst guy, it's terrible. You know, it's like, but you're the person that hired them and put them in that position. I don't know how self-aware that, like, are you, do you guys know that you're in on this? Are you true believers? I still wonder that about the cult we're in. Like, you know, fundamentally, the Jehovah's Witnesses are ruled by seven old men that live in New York. Do they know it's bullshit?
How cynical are they? Yeah.
Or are they just brainwashed like everyone else and they're just going like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the other thing that, like, going back to beginning, I would like to think that liberal Hollywood and the news media and comic books and TV shows and movies that are overwhelmingly trying to tell us, you know, I think a better way to live. I would like to think that they're making 100, 1,000 Fred Rogers every day. You know, they're guiding people to the light. But sure. I know for a fucking fact that there are people on YouTube, people on Twitch, people on radio, people with websites, people with big political platforms that are manufacturing Roy Tillmans by the dozens and hundreds every fucking day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, at some point, we have to reckon with that. Like, you know, like, how in a free society where you value free speech can you let these factories that just stamp out permanently damaged men? You know? Like, it's weird.
We got
Roy Tillman factories all over the fucking place. And of course they'd say, we got the factories that turn men into boys or men into girls and girls into men, and it's all crazy, fucked up, mixed up world, blah, you know. But like
sure.
Yeah, okay, maybe. But also you are stamping out a bunch of Roy Tillmans, and that's a problem. And sure. I don't know how to solve that. You know,
that's the thing. Some of the fundamental things we value, like free speech, come in direct conflict with doing anything about that. So,
but it's wild to me that, like, there's not official channels that, like, it seems to me that with a couple $1,000,000, you could grab some young, attractive people. Because I think the facts are on, broadly speaking,
propaganda. Aaron, is that what you want? Propaganda?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. If someone is pumping shit into my swimming pool, I will counteract it with the appropriate amount of bleach. I will not just let my pool turn into a sewer pit.
Fair.
Yeah. Fair. Like, what, you're going to fight a one-sided propaganda war? What the fuck? You're going to show up with a knife to a gunfight like Whit Farr? Is that what Holly's trying to tell us? Like, no. I mean, but again, so it's like, I've always heard that the
The cure for bad speech is more speech, good speech. I don't see anyone doing that in the public square. I don't really see people taking the Roy Tillman ideology seriously and dismantling it. You know,
so
like in
the
50s, what broke the Ku Klux Klan is Superman and his radio show and his TV shows just utterly exposing for how ridiculous they are. They're men that wear white dresses and call each other cyclopses and dragons. What the fuck?
Truly ridiculous.
And maybe this is Fargo. Maybe Fargo is starting to say that the emperor has no clothes. Look at how ridiculous these people are. But
well, yeah, it's tough because so the point of this episode at the end is we need a little bit of love and understanding in the world to counteract this. Yes. And the problem with fighting a message of hatred is that to get people stirred up enough, it almost takes another message of hatred. You're not doing a counterpoint. You're doing the same thing just from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to stamp out the people who are willing to resist becoming the Roy Tillmans, resist becoming part of that machine? You got to get them motivated. And anger is a very effective motivating tool. And you don't want more anger and hatred in the world. You don't want to just get out there and say, look how much these people suck. Their, you know, philosophies are all terrible. We hate them. Get mad about it. That's not a solution. But how do you manufacture a love and understanding and trust in people in ways that really move the needle when the other side has that powerful lever of anger and hatred?
Yeah, I don't know. Because
that's the real true other side of this, is not more anger and hatred of these particular people who are doing this bad thing. It's got to be something that brings us together, not further apart.
But global fascism wasn't brought down in the 40s by, you know, rainbows and Care Bear stares, right?
No, like bullets and tanks. And yeah.
So at some point, like, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know what the answer is when you've got like team hate versus team love and tolerance. Like, love and tolerance, if they go down swinging that way, will get wiped off the map. And
I've been thinking about this.
Team hate will just fall apart. But I don't know. It's,
yeah, but that process is scarring. The process is
rough.
Sure. I've been thinking about this in terms of like True Detective, right? We're covering that season, the new one. And I keep thinking about that saying that came out of the first True Detective, where we're the bad men who keep the other bad men from the gates,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And that is such a bullshit thing. Like, it's couldn't enough people who are good men, good people, keep those bad men at the gates as well? Do we need bad men keeping bad people away, or can we have enough good people standing up to those bad people?
Yes, but
if we don't have the bad people in the first place, do we need the bad people keeping them from the gates? Shouldn't that be the thing that we're striving toward, is getting rid of the bad people, not manufacturing the bad people in the first place, more to keep the bad people away?
Yeah.
This is crazy. This is the whole gun argument, right? Like, we need more guns to keep the people with guns. But yeah, ridiculous.
That's a good point. I don't.
We're getting too deep in the politics stuff, maybe. Although this show is encouraging it. Don't say this show's not. It wants us talking about these things, and I think we do need to talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
But we also need to talk about the next part of this episode, where a shootout ensues. We got Wit shielding Dot. He sees Roy run to the dugout and follows, and Roy ends up stabbing him to death and leaving through the tunnel. But as soon as he emerges, the FBI grabs him because they've been tipped off by Gator. And that was, boy, after what happens in this scene, that was a welcome surprise, because this is the scene where Roy kills Wit because he is not the bad man. Wit is not the bad man, and the bad man gets the better of him here.
Yeah, he hesitates beyond all reason.
His first resort is not to jump to violence. He wants to avoid it if he can, and that gets him killed.
And he did, like, I did think it's because I didn't even notice on the first watch, but on the second watch, I noticed that as Roy is making that final charge, Farr does try to shoot him. He does. You know, knives can win over guns when you're in that, like, 10-foot lethal radius, and that's exactly what happened.
You need a bigger gun than that to stop somebody at that range.
It is tragic. And I thought there's a couple other things I noticed during like the all out battle between the FBI and the Y'al-Qaeda forces that they were playing like what I could only describe as like Ken Burns Civil War documentaries music.
Okay.
You know, like the like whenever they show the footage of Shenandoah and all the bodies, and you know they'd have the fiddle, the mournful fiddle or mm-hmm. Monica playing, and I thought that was interesting.
Well, that's what these people think they're doing, right? It's fighting some grandiose civil war for their own
rights.
And
then like that, like if we do like in individual struggles for justice, that some good people are going to die, and that's kind of required. You know, mm-hmm. that the struggle is going to require sacrifices from some of us. And I don't know. It might be deliberate commentary that it did seem that the people that suffered the most were women and minorities. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's always, I think, in terms of like whenever you go through revolution, whenever you go through civil unrest, it's always the most vulnerable people in society to suffer, you know?
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's what they're trying to say there. But
and I'm looking at Roy here.
It's not, it wasn't, more to your point, Roy didn't fall in vain. Roy. Yeah. Will didn't fall in vain because other good people were at the end of that tunnel to pick him up, to back him up.
Absolutely.
But it still sucks. It still sucks.
Heartbreaking, man. I wanted him to live.
Shocking.
I've been talking this entire season about he is my go-to character for characters that I like. He's number one.
Yeah,
with Indira and Dot, like, and Wayne and her whole family, like, right behind them. But like, such a brave man, a man trying to do the right thing at every turn, and he pays the price for it.
It was as shocking as if like Marge had gotten her head blown off in the original. Like if Peter Stormare got her gun and blew her head off right before he's taken. It's like that. It's just like they're truly righteous cops aren't supposed to die in this show.
No, but it just. Yeah, I think he's showing that cost, right? If we want the good men, not the bad men, keeping the bad men away, then there's going to be some of them who pay the price, and I think it's reasonable. I'm looking at Roy's actions here, and I'm thinking, this is a man who is spoiling for a fight.
Yeah,
because he makes it to this dugout well before Whit does. I mean, Whit follows him, and yet, and he says, you know, down that tunnel is my destiny, my salvation. Mm-hmm. And yet he did not take the opportunity to escape when he could have. He waited in that dugout to kill the good man.
And I think he probably was literally waiting for Dot. Like he couldn't quite leave.
Probably,
He was waiting for Dot to try to, you know, this is the destiny and he was going to put it and then go on to, I don't know, where the hell he expected to go from here. Mm-hmm. Undisclosed bunkers in North Dakota, but
sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, some old missile silo, who knows.
I also like the interesting note of him calling Trooper Farr son, you know, get out of my way, son, when it's his actual son that's going to be his downfall.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, it's used in a very racist kind of son, boy kind of way. But
yeah, yeah.
Did him in.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so the battle's kind of over here. The forces of good have won, and Dot comes upon Gator, who apologized to her, and she hugs him, and Gator asks, did you really see my mom? She says, no, she was just a dream, a beautiful angel in a dream. And then she promises to bring him cookies in jail, and she wants to thank Whit for saving her life, but the FBI tells her he's dead. And I love how they tell her. It's just shaking of the head. No, you can't do that. I'm sorry.
Crushes her.
Yeah. Her reaction is devastating.
And the other thing legally is I do think you might wonder, well, maybe Roy could get out of this or Roy could win the appeal, but murdering a state trooper with a knife that you have on you covered in his blood, you're not getting, that's life without parole all by itself.
Sure. Yep.
So I think maybe that serves a little bit of storytelling purpose. And also, this is a long-standing bald move grudge, but I'm definitely going to get my licks in. Oatmeal raisin cookie, the preferred cookie, the cookie of choice by racist, misogynist, homophobic assholes everywhere.
If he wasn't already going to jail, he should be locked up for liking oatmeal raisin cookies.
Yeah, that's a mid-level felony in every state that's worth living in, to be honest.
Yeah.
So just wanted to point that out.
The other thing I want to point out that we had talked about in previous episodes is whether or not Dot is delusional about having seen Linda. We wondered if she really thought when she told Gator, I saw your mom, if that was true. It turns out, no, she's not delusional. She understands that she didn't actually see her.
But in the moment, I think she did. I don't think she was lying to Gator.
You think so?
I don't think
so. In that
so,
moment of that high stress moment, now that it's
the high stress, the accident, the fact that she was kind of in a dreamy, she hadn't slept in days, and she added a concussion to that, and everything kind of got woozy. Yeah, I don't. I don't think she malicious. Although it's weird because they filmed it like it was malicious. There was like, because I think that Juno Temple's a very good actor, and I think that she can, there's a difference between her saying something and like as a hopeful carrot to dangle in front of someone that she hopes to get on her side, and there's also a way she can say it with a gleam in her eye that says, I'm sticking it to someone who's fucking me over right now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the latter is the performance she gave, even though everything else in the series makes me think that it was legit. So I don't know, might have been a misfire, or I could be way off base.
Sure. And then Dot is driven home, and we kind of stick on her face here with the camera as she processes everything that's just happened and everything that is going to happen. I think this is an amazing performance from Juno, and I'm
100%.
I'm looking at this. I eventually come down on a side, but I'm questioning, is she trying to force herself to be happy because Roy got away, or I mean, he lived. I mean, he didn't get away, but he lived. And I don't know that that's necessarily what she wanted, because he's still out there, right? Is that still dangling over her head here, or does she feel like she's gotten away and now she's trying to remember what happiness felt like? And I felt like it was the latter. I felt like, oh my God, this is over. I now need to settle back into being comfortable, being happy.
Yeah, I'm going
Am I
back
gonna
to Scotty
be able
and
to?
Yeah.
Yeah, what is it going to feel like when I reunite with my actual real family for the first time?
And it's interesting that both of these halves of this the episode are ended with this intense close up on an actor that just emoting despair going to joy.
Uh-huh.
Sam Spruill did a great job with Ula. And she's killing it here with Dot. Like I always like that when you just a wordless scene where you're just watching the actor process what's going on. I thought John Hamm did a great job on his toxic walk a couple episodes back, but yes. I really enjoy that Holly's not afraid to just, you know, in a media environment of quick jump cuts, he is fine just letting a good actor suggest what's going on in their interior selves. And it's so especially when you're watching someone who's up for it. And I think Juno Temple, like, again, I did not see this when I first started watching her in Ted Lasso. Mm-hmm. But goddamn, she's got the stuff.
Absolutely. So Dot is reunited with her family and gives them all big hugs, and Lorraine comes out of the lion house here to congratulate her on shooting Roy, on being that tiger, I guess.
Gives her the coldest, waspiest hug an old billionaire debt collector can give. But it's still, it's meaningful to them both. You can tell that there has been not a huge amount of character development on Lorraine, but
a respect developed.
That's what it is. I finally put my finger on it. Lorraine did not learn anything new. Mm-hmm. It's just that she now counts Dot as one of the good people.
Yeah.
She thought Dot was one of those bad people to deserve the debt stuff, you know? She thought Indira was one of those lazy, careless people to deserve their debt and don't deserve the nice things. But now she's included them. It's like a racist meeting a black person at work and being like, instead of like, oh, I'm wrong about black people, it's like, oh, I found the good one. She's found the good poor person.
Yeah.
You know? She's found two good commoners, and she's going to invite them in to her castle to be their wards.
Mm-hmm. The irony being, she's not at all poor. She's married to her son, who is very rich. Yeah, it's It's interesting.
Shit, Roy's probably loaded, you know, if you want to come. But sure. Yeah, she was a 15-year-old runaway, and that's who she...
Yeah. And we'll talk more about Lorraine here when she goes to the penitentiary in a bit. But let's jump ahead a full year. It's the anniversary of Whit's death. Dot takes Scotty out to the grave to put some flowers on it. And she finds Indira also there. And they talk about Whit's six sisters and Dot's new job helping out with the Lion car sales business. Whit had six sisters. Boy, no wonder he was so nice, is what Dot says.
Okay, he was raised by women.
Uh-huh.
I like the idea that Dot probably wanted to be more involved in her husband's business, but, you know, she's on the lam, so she can't have her face shown.
Yeah,
but now she's
absolutely
truly free in a way that she thought she was 10 years ago, but now she's truly free.
Yep.
True to live her life without fear, and that looks good on her.
Yeah, it's exciting. And she's free to do that because Roy is in the federal penitentiary in Thompson, Illinois, and he gets a visit from Lorraine, who tells him, "You thought that this was your punishment, but no, your real punishment is about to begin." She has apparently decided to forgive the debt of a whole bunch of prisoners in exchange for them making Roy's life a living hell. This is a scene I cannot feel good about. As much as I hate Roy, as much as I want to see him punished for the things he's done, I cannot feel good about the way it happens. Because this is another bad person wielding power in ways that should not be allowed in order to torture another bad person. Nothing is good about this scene. Other than the acting. I don't want to get it wrong. This is a good scene. It's just... Yeah. I don't like the outcome of any of this.
Yeah, then there's other shows where I can get down, like, you know, we're talking about Game of Thrones, like there's that scene where Sansa feeds a person to dogs, you know, and it's like, I never walk around being like, I don't know if I agree with this kind of justice code. I don't know. The guy didn't even stand trial. I'm like, fuck yeah. I hope those dogs tear you apart. But it is weird for the show with what it's preaching this season to essentially say some people deserve to be held accountable to the justice standard that they believe in. Like Roy's a Old Testament fire and brimstone guy, eye for an eye. So he's going to get a rape and a beating tenfold from what he, you know, for the rest of his life. It's going to be an unending nightmare of
sure.
rapes and sexual assaults and beatings and humiliations and... it's so weird though, like, you know, like, again, I wouldn't bat an eye if that was a Game of Thrones kind of thing, because it's all medieval, right? But this is medieval, and it's a bad person inflicting it's a lowercase evil person inflicting old school stone tablet skull fuckery onto a uppercase E evil person. And with the show's themes of forgiveness, I do wonder, is Holly critical of this? Because it doesn't feel like the show is critical of this.
This feels like the moment you want to stand up and cheer, right?
We do need bad men and women to keep the other bad men and women out. Because, like, Indira's a good woman. She's excused from the room because she's too good to see what's about to happen. I was pretty conflicted on how to feel about that myself.
Yeah. Whereas
because, honestly,
I would not have been...
Too many Americans celebrate the fact that our penal system includes a little side helping of rape when criminals get put away. And it's like, that's a real thing in our society, and the show's kind of leaning into it, which, I don't know, it's complicated feelings all around.
Yes, and that has been kind of the name of the game for this season for me, is this is a little too real and a little too tongue-in-cheek and silly in places for me to feel good about it. But in this particular scene, it's all about... Who's good? Who's bad? Who can get justice? Who can dish out justice in this scenario?
Yeah.
I would have zero problem if Dot had shot John Hamm in the head, if Dot had shot Roy in the head, killing him on the spot.
Yes.
That is justice in my mind.
Yes.
This is not how justice should be performed. In my mind, it should not be powerful people behind the scenes wielding power in ways that are outside the bounds of the law in order to punish even bad people.
Yeah, if we think the punishment for the crime that Roy committed should be ritual sodomy for the rest of his life, then God damn it, we should put that in the books. And the judge sentence right. you to roll cucumber condom rape for 30 years with no parole. But no, that's not the justice system that we sign up for and want, but it's kind of the one that we kind of expect. And that's a duality to us living in this country that we probably do well to think of. Because I don't know. I'm a wretchedly naive Star Trek fan that would be appalled if Picard would do something like that to even the worst. Like, that's the whole, like, yeah, I'm a Federation yes. guy. You know, you go and do your time in prison. That's humane. And mm-hmm. you'll have counselors. They'll try to help you. They'll try to help you understand and atone and come to grips with, like, your guilt. And maybe one of these days you could return to some form of society. The only way we keep you locked away permanently is if you're a permanent threat and a danger.
Yeah.
This is just and that's torture. Not what this is. So, yeah. But I understand why it would be satisfying to a lot of people because, you know, I don't have a lived experience of being beaten and raped by the people who are supposed to take care of me.
No, this is the moment in the episode where you're supposed to cheer. You're supposed mm-hmm. to get on Lorraine's side and
the
say,
musical cues,
fuck yeah,
the,
give it to
her.
Him.
Her walking out to the numbers in March yep. is supposed mm-hmm. to be every bit as cool as Danish Graves humiliating Roy on the debate stage, which that's also justice. But
sure. Yeah, I just, man, it's hard for me to get behind that stuff.
We're weak. We're weak men, Jim. We don't understand what needs to be done.
Yeah, but with enough of us, we can keep it going.
Yeah. Enough of us betas can get together and take the alphas down.
The guy in the trunk is trying to get out. We'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We just put the ads in the wood chipper. Welcome back. Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the next scene. I want to talk about the state of John Hamm's neck in this scene.
Yes!
He has a swastika tattoo. Prison seems to somehow have made him a even worse person.
A racing swastika. It's all streamlined and swoopy.
It is, yeah. It's circular and, yeah.
I guess that is kind of low-key a fact of maximum security penitentiary. You will be sorted by the race, and you will fall in line with the white supremacist, or you will die or spend your whole life in protective custody.
Apparently, yeah, it's a safety thing. But he's in here saying it when he doesn't need to, right? He's saying the terrible racist things to somebody who he has no stakes saying this to.
And like I said, I do see the delicious irony of him being like, "This is how life should be." Mm-hmm. You know, the men divided by races, the strong stacked on the weak, the strong fucking the weak and killing their rivals. And well, Lorraine's she's the top dog in this system. So you're getting what you think you deserve, apparently. Mm-hmm. Oh, you didn't think you deserved this? There is something ironically satisfying about that, but like you said, it's just not justice.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Dot and Scotty. They arrive home after putting flowers on Whit's grave and find Wayne sitting in the living room with old Munch. He says he's not done with her because the debt must be paid. And Dot asks, why must the debt be paid rather than the debt being forgiven? Which kind of catches Munch off guard. He has no response, and Dot invites him to help make the game night biscuits and chili, and he does. I don't know where to stop on this scene, because it all just kind of flows. Do we want to stop maybe where they sit down for chili? So they talk about the deal that he made with Roy. Dot says that he knew the risk, and he made a choice, and it bit him, and he should probably accept that, as opposed to trying to pay off this debt.
I just want to give props to John G, I believe it was, who wrote in when you were gone with this really interesting analysis of this season through the lens of anthropologist David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And I'll be damned if this didn't feel like it was cribbed from his email, which probably means that you're correct. The Holly had read this book and it was in his mind, because this whole like, why does debt need to be repaid? Since you were gone, Graeber's thing is debt didn't used to be something that you owed to an institution. A debt was like, you know, like when you go back to how barter societies worked, it wasn't like, you know, we're taught in school. It's like, oh, you need a chicken and I need a rake. Well, I'll trade you one chicken for one rake. And what happens if a rake's not worth the chicken? And oh, no one could get anything done. So we had to invent money and everything was good.
Yeah.
But in reality, the way those systems worked is like they weren't strangers. These were your neighbors. The people who lived in your village, like the entire thing was held together by a complex web of debts. Like Sally did this for me, so I owe her. But then I did this thing for Tom and he owes me. And Sally, it's like it was a system that fostered independence and not self-reliability, but reliance on your community.
Yeah.
And instead, debt has been turned into this individual obligation that we're all individually owed and we're responsible for. And even if there's no way to meaningfully pay it back, you can get like, you know, Sally wouldn't loan you 100 rakes for one chicken. She'd be like, the fuck you need 100 rakes for? But like, you give a 16-year-old kid a credit card for $10,000. What the fuck?
Yeah.
And that's what she's saying. Like, why does debt need to be repaid? Why isn't the better thing to forgive it?
And we do this in aspects of our justice system and society already. Like, think about murder, or someone accidentally killing somebody else in a true accident. We don't necessarily throw that person in jail and say the debt must be paid, you know?
Yeah.
We can forgive that. Why can't we do the same with borrowing of money, borrowing of assets?
Well, I've been working on this thought for a while. But I've had this thought that, like, I've only seen that kind of egalitarianism in, like, amongst equals. Like, I've seen people in wretched poverty be like, hey, man, what's 20 bucks between me? You know, I go back to high school. Like, who cares? And I've seen super wealthy people, like, be very sharing with their, like, you know, oh, you lost a car? Here, take mine. But I've never seen, like, a rich people give a poor person that's not some kind of obvious showy act of charity, and I've never seen obviously a poor person, like, anytime there's like disparities of that, people get like fearful that they're going to get robbed from. If everyone has roughly the same value, then we're all in the same boat, so give a little, take a little. And if any economist or person studied the issue would tell you that we are living in a time of kind of rampant inequality. We're living in a second gilded age, and maybe, you know, and those things are, you've got those things are come into, like, you know, shitty labor conditions and debtors' prisons and things like that. And if we don't want to head back to those bad old days, we're going to have to get a handle on how we treat and view debt in society. And the answer is not just everyone forgives debts. So you don't keep track and willy nilly.
Of course, you don't forgive someone who goes out with a knife and murders somebody intentionally.
Right.
You don't just let them off the hook. But there are circumstances under which that, you know, a killing is not punished.
Yeah. And that's what it is. We're obsessed with punishment of things rather than, like, mitigation and healing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, absolutely.
But yeah, this debt first 5,000 years, John G's email, I think, was, if you guys listened to that feedback, you probably were nodding along as this played out. But I even, like, the symbolism is so good. Like, when he's talking about flesh was taken and a pound must be returned, what does she give him at the end of the episode?
A biscuit. Pound
of biscuits. What does a Catholic priest give you when you get absolution, forgiveness of your sins?
An assignment to say a bunch of prayers.
But also, he gives you the Eucharist. What the body of Christ, that's literally the flesh of Christ. She's giving him a pound of her flesh because she made this thing with love. And I thought, like I said, this on a metaphoric and the parable fairy tale level, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Can we talk about some of the speeches here? Because, like, I think Holly is intentionally telling us that Mr. Munk here is an unreliable narrator, because he's talking about taking a Viking longboat to the New World.
Okay, we're in the next scene here.
Oh,
should I describe this scene real quick?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead. I thought we were already there. I'm sorry.
No, it's kind of in two halves. So after they make the dinner, they sit down for chili and biscuits. And Munch tells him the story of how he was essentially destroyed by eating the sins of the rich. He's been damned to carry that with him. Dot tells him that the cure is to eat something made with love and joy, and offers him a biscuit, and he eats it, and this really goofy, just elated smile comes over him. And that's where we end the episode.
And I do love that every time he tried to get into his grim, dark edgelord, life isn't a circle, it's a line with the mother at one end and this is the other. And she's like, well, I don't even know what that means, but
going
to have to wash your hands. And even washing your hands is kind of a baptism. You know, they're very, very Christian in the scene, down to having Scotty pray, which was honestly a bit of a shock to me. But the way he talks, like, I don't think his story makes sense. He says he took a Viking longboat over to North America, which, fine, maybe Erik Leifson did discover North America. I think there's plenty of evidence of that. But then he rode horses with the Plains tribes. So the Vikings, it came like hundreds of years before the Europeans. Like, Columbus landed in 1492. The Vikings were, like, fucking around in, like, the 1100s, 1200s, right? Horses were introduced to North America by Europe. How the hell was he riding horseback with the natives fresh off the Viking boat up until the Europeans came back with their cannons and their guns? And then he went back to Europe, and then he ate this. But, like, okay, now we're at four, like, you know, you're in the 1500s before colonization began. We're already past the time the old monk ate stuff in the old kingdom of Welsh. So it's like, I think Holly is not an idiot. He knows his history enough to know. The fact, oh, here's another one. He said, when I was born, freedom was a potato. Potatoes didn't come from, are not native to Europe. So, like, I think this is, I actually think that one way you can understand Ule here is that he is a deeply traumatized man who has invented a past to try to make sense of the things that's happened to him. Because if you try to literally understand his story, none of the facts fit together in any kind of timeline that he gets.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know enough to call him on whether he knows enough or not on this.
But this and Dot traveling 500 miles in a single night on foot. I think these are all, like, Holly intentionally pointing out that this is a fairy tale. It's set in modern times, but it is, you know, a fairy tale. It is a parable. It is something that you're not supposed to take literally true.
Yeah. And I mean, thematically, all of that is true here with the stuff with debt, and, you know, her holding out the cure, which is this eating something made with love and joy. I mean, him as a sin eater, I think is doing a lot of great work here in this final scene. And he's kind of explaining, you know, we know this because we read Reddit and have a podcast where we talk about it. But this concept of sin eater is finally explained. What did we see happen in that scene back there 500 years ago? Well, we saw him kind of taking on the sins of the rich, you know, and in my mind, him taking that on, him swallowing the sins of the rich, means he's literally putting up with the bullshit that they do. And Dot is freeing him of that. He doesn't have to put up with this anymore. And I don't know what his actions are after this. I don't know if he goes and becomes some vigilante or something, or if he, you know, this is truly the prescription, is just have love and joy in your heart. But that was very much front and center to me, is he's being freed of that burden of allowing them to control him.
There's something really fun. I can't remember if it's on our Discord or if it's on the subreddit, but someone said, did anyone else think that when Munch ate the biscuit, this was going to happen? And they showed the, like, the Last Crusade, where the guy drank the wrong grail, and he's instantly ages and dies and blows away. It is an interesting question about, what happens next. But I think, again, I don't think you're supposed to literally wonder about that. I think it's like wondering what happens to the fox after he spurns the sour grapes. Did he ever get the good grapes? Who knows? Who cares? That's not the point of the story. But
I mean, Dot's saving a man who has become so, who has so internalized the idea that he is bad because the rich have told him so. Because Lorraine has told him so.
He's fully internalized it.
Exactly.
It's his code. I have to live by this. I can't. It's. Yes. I don't want to kill you. It's just what
it's the code demands. And Dot is freeing him from that idea, that conception of himself. And I think that is the true message of the season, is why are we allowing the rich to define who our value and our worth based on things that they control and are in their own self-interest?
Yeah, and it ties in so well with the abuse angle with Dot, because, you know, as we appreciate with Karen, nothing that Roy did was ever his fault. Like, Karen should have shot her first time. Karen shouldn't run when I told her to stay still. It was never like, I just lost control and I don't have any control of my life, and it's all bleed. It's always like, it's her fault. And she says, like, you know, this stuff that they make us feel that way. They
make this concept
us swallow
of breaking
and then
these
tell us
women,
it's our
right?
fault. Yeah.
Yeah. And Dot has always been resilient against that.
And she takes her to free Munch here.
Yeah.
She found the cure in love and forgiveness amongst, you know, and like, it's so, Wayne's such a great guy for her, right? You know,
like, that's what I mean.
Really,
he brought it
made
all
in heaven.
Yeah, absolutely. But he brought it all around. Holly did at the end of
and
this.
You know,
I mean,
the other thing is, if Wayne were a real man like Roy, every one of them fuckers would be dead, because Ule would have killed them all. If he'd have started that, like, you think you can come into my living room and talk to my woman in front of my... He would have fucking gutted them like a fish. But because Wayne is the type of man that he is, they all lived.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's kind and gentle and loving.
And so it's like, that's the other thing. It's like, someone pointed this out. I'm not sure where. Maybe it's even feedback. But like, you can tell a lot about them by Scotty, you know, this stinky weirdo. Because there's even a scene where, like, when Wayne takes his coat, he kind of, like, you can tell, like, Ule is fragrant. He has a
500 years of funk.
But no, like, Scotty never's like, who is the weirdo in the dress? Why is this stinky man? And, like, she's just, like, open-hearted and empathetic and curious. And seems like they're well on the way to doing a good job of raising her.
And I go back to that scene, which, you know, was kind of played for comedy, about, oh, look how fucked up Wayne is, back when the family comes into the Kia dealership and they want to trade in their car. And it's like this old busted ass car, 10 years old or whatever, and it's worth like maybe $6,000. And they want to get this new car that they can't afford, that's maybe worth 30, 35. And the salesman comes in and says, well, we can't do this, obviously. It's ridiculous. Is there anything we can do? And he's like, nah, just make the trade. He's forgiving a debt there indirectly, right? He's creating a debt and immediately forgiving it. And that kind of all comes back into play here with what kind of person he is and why Dot would be attracted to him in the first place, because he embodies those qualities. I don't think that's him hit on the head, electrocuted, brain not working right, scrambled egg kind of thing. This is just who Wayne is.
Yeah. I think he's fully recovered. Yeah, there is no, like, this isn't Wayne after he got Sparky. This is how Wayne's always been.
Maybe not to the extent where, because he would go bankrupt, right, if he were doing this with every customer. But he sees a scenario where he can selectively, like, do a good thing, and he does it.
I saw also suggested that maybe the whole idea is that him and Dot are a true partnership, that maybe Wayne is gone a little bit too, like, just give cards away, and Dot's the back end now person. It's like, oh, no, we still need to make money. You know, if we go out of business, it'll be nothing but the bastard card dealerships out there. So we have to make money.
But can we do it with compassion and love?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And again, that I'm already taking this fairy tale way too serious to try to. but yeah, the point is everyone here lives happily ever after, unless Ule takes a bite, smiles, and dies, which I think he would be fine with, too.
That's the thing. And I look at this, you know, his description of why he did this in the first place, why he swallowed the sins of the rich, is because he was starving.
Yeah.
He didn't feel desperate, like he had a choice.
Right.
And then you come in with this biscuit, and Dot being someone who does have more and is able to provide something for someone less fortunate, hands it to him debt-free. And just says, this is for you. And that is the thing that he needed to realize that he doesn't, like, together they can overcome any kind of feeling of obligation or debt. And still, you know, Dot's not going to make him make biscuits next week, right?
Right.
Like, you need to go out and get a job so you can afford more BizQuick so we can all feast on your biscuits.
Is Lorraine evil or not? I don't know. Apparently, this is hard for people to figure out. I know that if Lorraine was in 1500s Welsh and Ule, the next day after being abused by these old people, came to her crying at his feet and be like, I got all these sins on me. I was just hungry. I was going to starve. She'd be like, well, you chose to eat the food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's evil. I'm sorry. That would be an evil response. And it's literally what she does on a daily basis to everyone that she doesn't have the personal knowledge that these are actually one of the good ones. I think, like I said, might be lowercase e evil, but it's not good.
No, it's manifestation of greed.
And maybe that's what evil is. Like, it's not the opposite of good. It's the absence of it. It's like darkness isn't the opposite of light. It's just the natural state of things with light not shining on it.
Right.
So, like, maybe fussing over evil is just, well, you're just not good. And we're trying to promote good here.
That's the whole thing I'm getting at with the bad men at the gates keeping the other bad men away, right?
It's like, are we dark? I can see my hand in front of my face, and maybe it's murky. I wouldn't call it dark, okay? But it's not bright.
Yeah.
We want things to be bright. I want to be able to read my fucking newspaper. I need it to be bright. So
yeah, let's actively
strive toward
that. You're
happy with the murk, that's fine. I'm not, and I'm voting accordingly.
And we don't need you. We don't need you mucking things up. Get out of the way, because we're trying to do good things here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You will benefit from the room being brighter, too, I promise.
Yes, absolutely.
It's my favorite.
We're going to make so many biscuits, you're going to get one, too.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things I saw in the last 5 years is that, you know, it's common for, like, I don't know, super radical leftists to be like, you're going to get the wall, you know, right? Like, implication in the revolution, you're going to be against the wall and get shot. Mm-hmm. I saw one guy being like, that's right, you're going to get the wall and three more and a roof and healthcare and food because you're a human and it's your fucking right. Like, that's my type of aggressive politics. Like, I think everyone should get what human dignity requires, you know?
Yeah.
And if not, then you're just saying that, like, we can't do better and we're going to have some people out there scrabbling to survive, and we're going to have the attending crime, we're going to have the attending violence. And even though we could afford to make sure people don't have to do that, we just rather do it because that's the rules of the game and we like it. And I want to change those rules.
Yep. Have anything more to say about this episode or where we leave things?
No, but we have a
giant old mailbag full of people with things to say about this episode. And we'll probably be back next week for a wrap up, I imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that people have everything that they say at the end of this week, but we'll see. We'll see. Fargo at baldmove.com is how you send in feedback for potentially the feedback episode next week. Also, since this is the end of the road for Fargo, the series or the, well, I mean, maybe the series, like, I don't think they've got a season six ready in the wings. Like, Holly might come back in a couple years and do it, but it's the end of season five. If you'd like to follow us to see what else we're doing, we're right in the middle of True Detective. I think if you're a Fargo fan, you probably would like True Detective. We're covering that. And if you want to follow everything else we're doing, at Bald Move, every social media, at Bald Move, except for TikTok, at Baldest Move. And we're working on that. There's been some developments. We might get at Bald Move on TikTok soon.
Ooh.
And then finally, yeah, if you've enjoyed our coverage here and our independent voices, we could use your support. Support.baldmove.com to get ad-free feeds, bonus content, and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping two guys in the Midwest make it. Oh, we'll be right back with Fargo, you're darn tootin'.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
The fountain of conversation continues. Here's more Fargo. Alan is up first. He said, heard you two talking about the pig in the episode 9 podcast during the banter at the Tillman Ranch standoff. The pig is a fun little bit of jargon. Roy and the FBI SWAT team leader talk about facing off against the pig and 40 men. This is a nickname for the M60 machine gun. You can actually see a redneck technical made out of an old red pickup with a machine gun welded behind Roy in this scene. The female FBI agent also mentions a pig missing from the sheriff's inventory. Fun little background on the nickname. Like the M16, the first M60s were vulnerable to dirt and fouling, in addition to which their first users found them heavy and awkward, leading to their popularly being referred to as pigs. So squaring off against a machine gun with 40 guys is what he's trying to say.
That makes a lot more sense than anything we came up with.
Yeah.
Perfect. Casey S. writes in and says, blanket episode title referring to a blanket primary with the fake Roy's being used in the debate. What is so this in regard to? I have no fucking idea what this means.
So the episode blanket, there was an episode titled blanket, and I asked my guest host, I think it was Ron, what the hell does blanket mean? And no one knew. And this person wrote in, and I looked it up, a blanket, so just types of different primaries. You got an open primary, where like you're a registered Republican and you can walk into a Democratic primary and you can vote on all the Democrats, you know, but you can't do both. And you've got a closed primary where it's like, if you're a registered Republican, you can vote for your Republicans for the primary. And if you're a registered Democrat, you can vote. And if you're independent, I think you can caucus with one or the other, but you can't like do both. A blanket primary is like a super open primary where you say, I want this Republican treasurer. I want this Democratic secretary of state. I want this Republican. And you on and on, you pick who the best person for the job, regardless of party. And then the most popular of each category go forward to the primary. And supposedly it's a more democratic, gives people better choices in the primaries. You have better elections. I wish we'd go to ranked choice voting, which is the superior form of, you know, and there's lots of different types of ranked choice. I know there's like the star system. Anything would be better than the first past the post bullshit we got going on in this country. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. I think they're describing a blanket primary, and that's the only thing that makes sense.
I was not familiar with that term. So
me either.
Cool.
Chad K says, you asked what it meant to steal a man's lineage. The examples Munch used were to Welch, to Jip, and to Jew. So clearly he's showing how bad faith exchanges in the past carry forward as their lineage carries on the debt of that double cross. Munch explains it in a way that he doesn't see it that way exactly, alluding to the sins of the father do not pass on to the son. I want to believe. So he's saying, look at these racist slurs to Welch, to Jip, and to Jew. Like these have been synonymous with these, unfairly made synonymous with these types of people.
Yeah.
But I feel like he actually said to the Welsh, the Jip, and the Jew. I don't know. Like, I don't know if he's using them as verbs. That would make a lot more sense, but yeah. If that's true, that's a good explanation.
Yeah, I'm with you. All right, Kate from Dallas says, I was listening to the episode 9 recap and something you discussed in the feedback caught my attention and reminded me of a 2018 article with the director Adam McKay when he was promoting the film Vice about Dick Cheney. In the feedback, you contrast the old neocon versus the new MAGAs and referenced how many people look back at the Bush era with fondness compared to Trump, something McKay calls liberal amnesia. The article is quite long, but I think McKay has a beautiful way of putting this amnesia and the contrast of the old versus new into perspective. This is a quote from him. He says, really, what that shows you is the number of people for whom government is just about appearance. Bush and Cheney just kept up the facade, whereas this administration doesn't even remotely pretend. So when I hear people say, I miss the days of Bush and Cheney, what they're really saying is, I miss the days when people would at least pretend. He went on, every time I see it, I shake my head like, you've got to be kidding me. The world economy collapsed. We had the greatest military fiasco in U.S. history, apart from Vietnam. When I hear Trump makes you miss Bush, I go, there's no question that Bush and Cheney are way ahead of him in terms of damage done. He characterized such a Bush nostalgia bluntly by saying, now that my house is on fire, I long for when it was infested by bees. I think this quote, back here to Kate. I think this quote beautifully illustrates how insidious this type of nostalgia can be. We should not forget our house was infested by bees. When we gloss over these past issues, I think we set ourselves up to accept worse and worse implications. Worse and worse politicians. I shudder to think of the scenario in which we look back and Trump is the bees and something worse is the fire. I think of this quote often as a reminder to do something now before my house is on fire.
I don't agree with this line of thinking, all due respect to Adam McKay.
What part of it? Because there are things in here that I agree with.
This liberal amnesia is liberal amnesia because Bush and Cheney did things that the American people wanted and were behind. You want to make it out like that they just hijacked America and we did this all this. When 9/11 happened, America wanted revenge. America wanted for blood. Now there might be a couple people listening that were against it from the beginning. I got blood on my hands. I was a enthusiastic supporter of the global war on terror up for the first couple of years. I think I was an early ripcord puller and out, but like I got to deal with that. And I think that if you look at the polling, if you live through that process, the idea that they just came and hijacked America for their own neoconservative fascist ideals is a ridiculous understanding of how American politics works. And and also, if your house is on fire, you will long for the days when it was merely infested with bees. Because why wouldn't you? I want to go back to the bees where I was just getting stung every once in a while instead of my house being on fire and all my dreams being destroyed. Like, the pair, it's like it doesn't even work on its own merits. So, like, I understand the spirit of, like, we can't get complacent. And it's like, but, like, it is worse that we had people trying to do bad things within the rule of law. It's worse that they're going outside the rule of law. And if you don't understand why that's worse and why that's a unique threat, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I think I largely agree with you there. I don't have much to add to it because the sentiment holds for me too. I see the erosion of the fundamental systems. It's not simply a matter of people pretending to play by the rules. I think there were rules that people agreed on and did play by, mm-hmm. in large part there. And now that all bets are off on that front, people are saying, actually, there aren't any rules here and we're not playing by any rules. So
yeah, we're going, it's just a naked grab of power and no one can stop us because,
and the rules that do exist are being undermined by the fact that the rules that do exist are being undermined by the fact that there weren't rules in place for everything.
Right.
And now the people who were agreeing before are just refusing to, and that's breaking the systems that were working before.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I don't know.
Yeah, but look, you're wrong. We're all living through this history, doing the best we can, and we're all learning different lessons, and I think that's one of the things that Fargo didn't resonate, because I learned a different lesson from Adam McKay. I don't know what to say. Like, you know, Adam, that's Adam McKay's opinion. That's the conclusion he came through living that history. He's 10 years older than me. So he was 10 years older when he's going through that thing. Maybe had different experiences. Comes from Denver, Colorado, come from Southern Indiana. But I think I don't know. I'm telling a guy who's saying that I have an inaccurate view of history, he's got an inaccurate view of history.
Look, I don't long for the Bush days either. Like, I don't want bees or fire. I'd prefer back when we were making huge progress on unions and social welfare programs and community, and the country, you know, feels like it's going in a positive direction. Neither of those administrations felt like they were going in positive directions to me.
Yeah, but it is a difference.
I do think the fire is worse.
Somewhere between 50 and 90% of America wanting to go to war for bullshit reasons, but we did genuinely want to do it. Versus a third of the country hijacking the country and none of the rest of us have any say in it. Like, because you can course correct. You can be like, oh, that was fucked up. We should have learned a lesson, all of us as Americans, on that. And we won't vote that way. We won't support those things. But like, if they just take over and it doesn't matter, well, you're fucked.
Sure. Sure.
Ron Dawson, our co-host.
Who?
Never heard
of him. No.
Hey. Says, after watching episode 9, I was so livid I needed to hear my favorite podcaster sharing my frustration. When the Bald Move recap was finally ready, I had every confidence that now that Jim was back in his seat, he'd bring on the whoop ass. Maybe it's due to post-COVID brain fog, but the hammer never fell. Jim, how could you? What am I missing?
It's not, I don't think it was a brain fog. I think it was, I didn't watch those episodes in the capacity of a podcaster, and so they went down a little smoother. They were closer to a biscuit than the sins of the rich.
He had a drop biscuit, no doubt. He's pissed about episode 9. He says, how are not more people commenting on the abso-fracking ridiculous, ludicrous decisions made by Dot in this episode? She spits a whole season running from this monster only to get caught. Why in the heck fire is she not using the supernatural legs of hers to hightail it as far away from the ranch as possible? Fine. She goes in the house, again, gets lucky enough to snag herself a rifle. What does she do? Traps herself in a literal pit of death, leaving her rifle up top. Feels like the writers made her do all these ridiculous decisions because they needed the plot to bring her and Munch together. I heard you two mention that Indira's suggestion to hide caused her to do this, but I don't buy it. There's plenty of places to hide miles from the hellscape she is blessed enough to escape from. But there's probably plenty of grapes for that fox to eat. He just wanted them, man. He just really wanted this, and turns out they're probably sour anyway. Like, yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it is so on theme for the tiger to not be a tiger and to be punished for not being, you know, and that's like, yeah, it's like either either with that or you're not, man. I'm kind of in the middle, but sorry we didn't have the brimstone and fire for you, Ron.
Yeah. Yeah. I promise I'll bring it later. Amelia writes in and says, I wanted to touch on Jim's comment around Dorothy's smile at Lorraine's calling her daughter as being unearned. As a woman with a mother-in-law, I argue that this was an excellent choice and reflected perfectly the nuanced complexity of the in-law relationship. I don't think any woman alive with a mother-in-law would contend that their relationship is completely warm or cool. Most women at one moment hate their mother-in-law and in the next desire even the smallest validation. The choice to make Dorothy relieved at Lorraine's change of heart adds the tasteful layering that makes Fargo more than just camp. Somewhere in that no daughter of mine moment is the validation all married women seek from a mother-in-law, no matter how loathsome the woman may be. Dorothy in this moment is also championing Lorraine's possible redemption, which I admire. The opposite of debt, forgiveness. Hats off to Holly for understanding this. Yeah, I might have been too harsh, so I didn't bring enough thunder on some things, and I brought too much thunder on others. I get your point. This makes a lot of sense. I guess as someone watching fiction, I want things to really strongly connect. That's a bias of mine, is like, look, this is fiction. This is not real life. Sometimes realism added to a very well-told fictional story can be a bonus, can be desired even. But, you know, I want real strong connections between stuff in my fiction, and I just didn't feel it here. But I get your point. It makes a lot of sense.
I live my life by the rules set down in the Italian job. You don't mess with Mother Nature, mother-in-laws, or motherfucking crazy Ukrainians.
Okay.
Next up, Trev. I just wanted to know, or throw out how cool it was that Dot used the laundry chute ladder to escape from Roy's top floor, connecting back to Dot using the homemade laundry chute ladder to escape to the top floor at the beginning of the season. Chutes and ladders is crazy.
Nice.
Nice that the stay-at-home mom is a master at chutes and ladders.
Mm-hmm. All right, Corey B's up next. With all the Wizard of Oz allusions this season and the last, it's clear Whit Farr is the Cowardly Lion.
What?
Oh, I might have a hard time getting through the rest of this email calling him a cowardly lion right up front. All right,
he might have some buttermilk to put in these biscuits. You don't know.
Okay. Corey continues, he finally took a stand and his sins were eaten, stemming from his original act of fleeing the first encounter with Munch on the highway, backing down to Gator in the police station, Roy in the hospital, again on the ranch, giving Dutch Tombstone the tip to go to the ranch to save Dot, but not accompanying him, etc. What is Dutch Tombstone?
Oh, it's Danish Graves.
Dutch Tombstone.
It's
a hell of a name, but not a name in the show.
Dutch Tombstone. Yeah, okay, Danish Graves.
That makes a lot more sense. Unfortunately for him, in the end, he got, even after bringing a gun to a knife fight. Shades of T-Bone letting the walkers get him when he had a clear way out.
Well, that's a blast from the past. Ah, damn.
Yep. Whitfar actually would have been better off letting Roy walk freely down the tunnel hall because the feds were waiting for him anyway. R.I.P. Winston.
That's his character on the New Girl, because he played a big role in that show, I guess.
Haven't seen it.
I don't know.
Cowardly
what do you make?
Lion.
The thing is, like, the cowardly, I don't know.
Lion gets guts, right?
The problem with this, the cowardly lion's got too much of a negative connotation because true bravery requires fear. Like, if you're fearless,
otherwise
you're not
brave.
Yeah. So, clearly, Whit, in his standoffs, all the various standoffs he's had with the Tillman clan, I use that word deliberately. The Tillman clan, he was at some stage of terrified, but he still made the stand, which I think shows true courage. And the wizard didn't give these people anything. He just recognized the gifts they already had. So it's too bad that in this case, the cowardly lion got shanked by the wicked witch, the wicked warlock. Yeah. But I don't know if it's so who would be the Tin Man?
The Tin Man wanted grease for his wheels, right? I forget.
Where's the grease? Where's the grease? The Scarecrow is obviously Ula.
Okay, yeah. I can see the resemblance.
Anyway.
That haircut.
True. It looks like a bowl of straw. Rachel's up next. She says, I know there's been a theme of doubt and sin this entire, or I'm sorry, debt and sin this entire season, and I found it moving at the end. Ula Munk, update named, reflect a Midwest accent, I guess, found forgiveness for the debts and sins that he was carrying. The chili and biscuit dinner at the end was amazing. It's just amazing religious allegory of forgiveness and communion. My old art history lessons came back, and I just thought his face at the end was rapturous joy. The actor was amazing in how he showed the physical manifestation of shedding the debt and sin that he had been carrying for centuries, and you can see the metaphorical weight just lift. Agreed. We also see how Dot and Wayne have raised Scotty to be genuinely kind. Oh, see, this is, I think I stole this from feedback, yep. Rachel. But yeah, he's this scarred, dirty, stinky guy, and it doesn't faze her one bit. She joins her parents in being welcoming and hospitable, holding his hand to say grace, helps to serve the chili. They aren't Midwest nice to him. They are genuinely nice, kind. You know, that's interesting that we began on a meditation of Midwest nice, that like they had a dictionary definition of how it's kind of like false and fake, and Dot was a fake Minnesota nice. She did not, you know, but by the end, it's genuine. It's not, I think Alan Sepinwall said this in review, it she wasn't being Minnesota nice, she's being a nice person from Minnesota.
Yeah. And what that requires is loving people and being kind, being everything that Wayne and Dot have taught Scotty to be. And you look at it in contrast, right? Like you look at all the things that Roy hates about Scotty when he sees her. Like, oh, boy, a girl with a boy's name, and shouldn't you be wearing a dress or whatever? Not, I don't know, jeans and a sweater. That kind of shit. That's the kind of shit that holds people back from experiencing community and love and kindness.
Do you remember us trying to figure out if Scotty was Roy's kid or not? Like, and how beside the point all that feels
we should have known in retrospect. Yeah.
It's still something
that's carved on bone. There's no way that bone came from Roy.
Yeah. I still think it's an open question, but it is also completely beside the point.
Right. Right. All right. Let's move over to George from Tampa here. Says, while the themes of debt were explored in many different ways throughout the season, I found the theme of sin the most affecting, maybe, is what he's trying to say here. So often we make the wrong choice, go down the wrong path, or stumble in our personal lives. We end up chastising ourselves over it. Shame is a powerful tool to make one feel like once they've done a single thing wrong, they can be defined by it. This is the price that we pay for our actions. This is the debt we owe those we disappointed or hurt, regardless of intention. The problem is, when does one stop whipping themselves? How long should one pay for the debt for sins committed ages ago? I'm not a religious man, but the simple idea that even after 300 years of loveless existence, that old Munch could be embraced by a simple yet loving gesture of being welcomed at the family dinner had me bawling by the time Munch bit that biscuit. In that moment of his story of sin and his characterization of himself as full of said sin didn't matter. And I hope we all have a table we can sit at where we are seen for who we are, not who we think we are because of our mistakes. We need more forgiveness and love in this world. It is the only real cure for a broken soul. Well said. Yeah, I was feeling exactly all of those things. And I think that's the story. That's the telltale sign of a successful final episode is I got it. I understood what they were going for and I felt it.
Moving on to Mary said, I just finished season 5, and after the warm fuzzies wore off, after watching Munk eat his communion bisquick, I admit I am left a little unsatisfied. Not really complaining. It turned out to be a pretty strong season, though it was a little loose in the plotting, had some pretty flat characters, and took a few episodes to ramp up. But after some thought, I think it's because something is missing in the Fargo stew this time. In its finest form, Fargo tells interesting and quirky stories that mix up the darkness of humanity with the kindness and decency we have, too, and both end up being driving forces of the story. I think the season pushed the kindness and decency to the side too much. The purely good cop was absent most of the season, then gets killed, largely because he puts his decency above his smarts. Wayne and Scotty are nominally decent people, but they are no help when the shit hits the fan. They accept Dot's obvious lies in a way that's borderline alarming by the last episode. How are they not picking up the danger that is old Munch? How much do they even know about what's actually happening? Or happened? What has actually happened? Do they do this as a defense mechanism? Hiding in their cushy lifestyle that they have been turning a blind eye to what's going around them in the world? Dot's largely good, but is so victimized by the brutality of the world that she causes a lot of harm to her family, to the cancer guy, arguably to Danish and Wit. Does this season even happen if Wayne is less accepting of Dot's obvious lies? Does it happen if Dot is upfront about the danger she and her family are in after the first kidnapping? I think it's fair to say that everyone good and decent this season is alive and able to live their relatively cushy and safe lives due to being connected to Lorraine. In fact, it is her moments of decency that help bring a good ending to the Lyon family. Maybe the moral is that without good leadership, we can't be good people? That's what I was trying to get to in the beginning, that there is something that I am missing, or there is some chemical receptor that is not binding correctly for me in this season as a whole. Because I'm with you. I think there were a lot of like mixed metaphors and muddled lessons. I think it brought it together very strongly at the end, but you're right. There is a lot of what I would call enabling behavior going on with Dot that served the story, and it's maybe understandable, but it's not like, I don't know if the answer is like, when your loved ones act crazy, you should just make up fun stories to tell each other to explain it until it all resolves amicably, because your rich
and
mother
hope you have a rich yeah
called in a favor and sent in the special forces to save you.
I'm not forgiving all of Holly's sins this season here. He doesn't get to eat a full biscuit. He maybe gets half a biscuit. But I think this final episode did a lot to crystallize themes for me and bring them together to where I'm recontextualizing and understanding better previous things that happened. Like there was a lot of showing the loving side of us in this. I mean, look at Indira taking Scotty in. She has no reason to take this child in. She has no business taking this child in. She's not equipped to do this. Look at her husband is a complete fuck up. He's not going to help. She's got a full-time job. She's trying to solve cases. And Dot comes to her and asks, I need this favor. I am down bad right now, and I just need someone to help me. And she does it because she's a kind person. As Lorraine describes her, you know, she's not built for the dirty work type stuff. She's different. I think a lot of those moments hit different after I see the final scene with the biscuit here, after I fully understand what he's trying to do.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm at a good spot at the end of the season, but I like a rewatch of the season. I'm not sure if it would completely like answer all my questions, or if it'd be like, golly, half of the season didn't even need to exist.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like I said, he gets half a biscuit here. I appreciate it more now that I've seen its fullness, but I still have problems. Like, I was not enjoying the ride as much as I felt I should throughout this whole thing.
And, you know, part of that is our job. Like, we can't just be like, oh, that's an interesting episode. Don't know what it means. We'll just wait for next week. See you then. It's 5 minutes. And, like, you know, we have to have stands. We have to ask questions. We have to try to decide whether Dot's supernatural and whether Ule is supernatural, and is he really 500 years old, and is Lorraine evil, and because that's what makes it interesting, why people keep listening. But sometimes it does get in the way of enjoying, you know. There's also, like, I just, someone described, there's like different types of enjoyment. Like, type one of enjoyment is like going to John Wick and like, god damn, that's fucking amazing, that's awesome, whipped ass, like I just innately enjoy the experience of it. And then there's like what this called like a type two enjoyment, which is like, I just read War and Peace, and it was long and difficult, and some parts I almost gave up, but oh my god, I am so satisfied at the experience of having read that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's almost a superficial versus an intellectual appreciation of something. And
podcasting is designed to destroy type B
or type yeah. 2 enjoyment.
Uh-huh. Unless we just watch the entire season and talk about it as a block, in which case it wouldn't be a very successful business. That's why it's like movies, our movie reviews, like I wonder how many movies reviews we would have a much more mixed take if every 15 minutes we paused it and recorded an hour podcast about how we felt about what's going on right now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like you're watching The Godfather, like, Jesus Christ, it's been 5 minutes of this dude I don't know giving a speech about some daughter that I don't know, asking some guy I don't know for his help, and then some fat guy struggling with his lines. I don't know where this is going, Jim. Seems like a yeah. shit show. Like, mm-hmm. that's no way to do, but with TV, you kind of have to. You kind of take it chapter by chapter. It's weird. For it's sure. a weird industry we're in here. But I appreciate you guys and gals indulging us and letting us have our say and say our stupid stuff and eat. And we come together at the end. We eat biscuits. If you would like to have some more Bisquick, if we had to mix up another batch, I guess it's wash your hands and start helping, you know, because it's a school night. I got things to do. Fargo at baldmove.com. If enough hands pitch in, we'll have a wrap up podcast. If not, If there's no Fargo wrap-up podcast in the feed, well, then we will know that humankind can't be trusted. We don't forgive each other our debts. We leave each other yeah. hanging. We don't keep our promises. And, you know, it's all going to hell in a handbasket. So Fargo at baldmove.com. Again, if this is the place where you're getting off, I would cordially invite you to follow us on social media because I bet we do a bunch of stuff that you would like as well as Fargo. Heck, maybe we're doing something right now like True Detective. Check us out at Bald Move everywhere, except for TikTok at Baldest Move. And then finally, support.baldmove.com. If you like what we're doing and you want to support us and you want to get some free stuff for yourself, support.baldmove.com. Like I said, we might see you next week. We might not. I do hope we see you in the future. Until that time comes, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.